This week I'm joined by Richard Gavin, who is the author of many acclaimed works of horror and the occult. His books include Sylvan Dread, Tales of Pastoral Darkness, Omens, and Primeval Wood. In this episode we discuss his book The Benighted Path, Primeval Gnosis and the Monstrous Soul, alongside discussions on horror, darkness, and the sacred. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my patrons for making this work possible, and if you'd like to support Omitics Podcast or become part of the community, please find the links in the description below. Enjoy. Richard Gavin, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation.
That's okay. So before we get into the questions about your book, The Benighted Path, which you just told me was published in 2015, for those who don't know you, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I'm a Canadian author. I primarily work in the areas of supernatural horror fiction, sort of in the more of the gothic and ghostly tradition, as well as writing various works of esotericism. So what I mean by that is somewhere between the philosophical and the mystical aspects of various, not only spiritual traditions, but also my own practice and worldview.
And you've recently got a collection of stories coming out called Grotesque, which is out very soon, I believe.
Yes, absolutely. It's Grotesquery will be published in September by Undertow Publications. And this is actually going to be my sixth collection of short fiction.
Okay. So how did you, how come you became a horror writer then, or esoteric writer?
Well, I think both of them really flowed from the same source, if you will. And a lot of it just really stretches back to a natural affinity that I had all the way into childhood. You know, experiences that I had through dream and even what I now realize were almost early forms of trance states and a kind of innate fascination with anything that was of the ghostly, of the macabre. I couldn't exactly assess why that was at the time, but it was really just, I suppose, like all people, you gravitate towards the things that really have a resonance with you. And as I sort of consumed more and more horror fiction and horror films, that eventually led me into reading about and researching and eventually practicing some of the areas that informed a lot of the supernatural fiction, which then also led me to philosophy and Eastern mysticism and so on and so forth. So it was really, you know, portals opening unto portals opening unto the portals. So I think it was more of a natural progression rather than anything that I consciously set out to do in any way, shape or form. I think, you know, I think there's very little of what is important to us, that is the things that are most vital to us, are anything that we actually consciously choose. I think there's just, you know, the things that are innately resonant with us that really invigorate us, we gravitate towards. Why that is, that's one of the great mysteries, I suppose. But really, it was just more of following that out as deeply as I could. I just had this, you know, this, as I said, a fascination, just a real, you know, just this nagging want of to get as deeply into this as I possibly could. And eventually, you know, this goes from a kind of external into more of an internal. You realize that it's becoming more of a process of more of a spiritual process. So I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, and I'm sure this parts of your biography might come back in, and this fascination that you've always had, because it plays a big part in the book. But before we go in too far, I do have to ask you the Hermetics question. So you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Okay, well, I love that question. So I would say the three I would choose would be Heraclitus the Obscure, one of my favorite of the pre-Socratic philosophers. Mm-hmm. I would choose Rudolf Otto, and I would choose Georges Bataille. And I'll tell you why I chose those three. Heraclitus, for those who may not be familiar with him, he was one of the pre-Socratic philosophers, but he was very much a process philosopher. I suppose he's most famous for the quote of "No man steps into the same river twice," but really that's a fine approximation of his view, which is that everything is constantly protean and moving and changing. You know, fire is what he believed to be the fundament of the universe, that it was constantly in this state of flow, that things were forever becoming. So that's a school of thought that I find a great deal of resonance with. Rudolf Otto was a theologian from the early 20th century. And in the 20s, he published a book that he's probably most well known for, and that would be The Idea of the Holy. And in The Idea of the Holy, Otto tried to explore the what he called the numinous experience, that which places us in a state of the sacred or the sublime. And for him, he developed what he called mysterium tremendum, which is his definition for it. And essentially, this is in pretty sharp contrast to the concept that most people have of what being in this numinous presence would be. To Otto, he essentially said that very often the human being is overwhelmed with a state of awe and terror, and it almost has this tinge of dread to it. Not because it was necessarily what they're seeing is horrific, but it's just that the human nervous system essentially evokes the strongest possible response it can, and it brings this vitality that he said was very often both beautiful and terrifying. So Otto, I would choose. The third I chose was Georges Bataille. And Bataille is, just such an interesting figure in the history of philosophy. I love his notion of immanence, in which he referred to as sort of the divine being in the material world. I loved his notions of transgression to reach a limit experience where essentially, it's almost like a reunion of the taboo and the sacred, where the egoic self is shattered and this full force of life flows out. So the reason why I think these three would be interesting is, everybody loves the sort of dynamics, I suppose, of people holding differing views and kind of debating back and forth. But personally, I don't really believe that the dialectical method is really an accurate means of conveying truth or recognizing truth. What's much more interesting to me is when you have a group of people, and they don't have to be famous philosophers, but a group of people who suddenly start kind of triangulating on the same area that is perhaps even beyond language. And one of the things that is interesting that comes out of that is this: there's an energy that builds up. There is a real vital, palpable experience that comes out of that. And what I like about this is that in the West, there are so many various philosophical traditions that have kind of what, be almost like a broken lineage. One person believes this, and then they go and hearken back to, let's say, the ancient Greeks. And so it's a lot of pieces putting together, trying to, again, triangulate this concept that they may be trying to convey to their readers. So I think it would be fascinating to have three thinkers from different eras who touched a lot on the same kind of concepts to see what sort of depth they could reach, with these three great minds in a room. So that's why I chose those three.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, Lucretius comes up time and time again on this podcast, and I think occultism goes hand in hand with that idea of becoming and constant change. I mean, I wonder if you could have, because obviously the classic sort of pre-Socratic protagonist or protagonist and antagonist or you could say duality of or competing philosophies sort of sort was Lucretius and Parmenides, so the idea of Parmenides having being and Lucretius having becoming or change.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could have a an occult system which was entirely being. I'm sure you could, but it would be a bit pig-headed, I imagine.
I would think so, yeah. And I think that, for me, well, I know, I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, I think that Julius Evola's writings were very much on this idea of being and kind of striving on this upward climb towards this perfected state where all things flow and becoming is essentially just more of the vulgar manifestations of that. Yeah, I would agree that I don't know how much you could participate in that, other than, I suppose, the ongoing aspiration. But Yeah, for me, the notion of becoming, whether it's, you know, manifest through Goethe or through a lot of the pre-Socratics, to me, it strikes a much truer chord. I see the idea of a process. I mean, none of us are the same people we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. We will not be the same people in 10 years. So it's an ongoing transformation that I think participation in is a much more vital avenue to take, rather than attempting to seize on a principle and say, well, this is it in its fundamental being. Because I do believe that all things are in flux, even if that flux is a gradual decay of matter. That's still essentially showing that this process is just ongoing.
It's interesting as well that you put Bataille in there, because Bataille, I don't know if you've read Michel Serres' biography of Bataille, but he's certainly not someone I think I personally would like to meet. He did come across as a very, very strange fellow. But now you mention his ideas of transgression are extremely alike and almost synonymous with the traditional occult idea of crossing the abyss, you know, this idea of dispelling or destroying the entire self through an experience of extreme inhuman horror, which you come out the other side with a certain form of understanding
Sure.
about your existence. That certainly comes through in Bataille, but whether it not it takes a different angle, you know.
Well, he was definitely a completely unusual figure, which I find I gravitate towards the works of individuals who do have that kind of extremity, even if they're not people I would necessarily want to, you know on a personal level. There's often, you know, Bataille's got so many fascinating theories in his work, and there's also a real vigor in his writing that I always find, you know, really enthusing to read. So, yeah, I think his ideas of transgression, of the shattering of the self, which again is akin to the kind of Dionysian experience of letting that go and willfully, you know, trying to overcome it to reach this more liberated, ecstatic state is something that I find, you know, pretty profound and beautiful.
I imagine these figures will come back up in our well, probably come back up in our discussion. But so the Benighted Path, how would you describe this book?
Well, essentially, how I would describe it would be a somewhat of a survey or an exploration of a particular process way of thinking. And it came primarily from my own personal work and my own personal views, as well as, you know, discovering various traditions and various philosophers and mystics over the years who had a resonance with it. And essentially, it's really a treatise, if you will, on what could be called night consciousness. And to give sort of a concise view of that, there is a quote from Ludwig Klages, who your listeners might be familiar with from some of the recent podcasts. And Klages said that in day consciousness we perceive, but in night consciousness we are visionary. So essentially, day consciousness, you could almost think of it as the Apollo aspect of the self. So it is the rational self. It is, you know, it is the I. It's the faculty that perceives and catalogs, and it's almost like a constitutive power. It tries to draw order and keep things maintained. It's, you know, it's the power that we manifest in our personas and so forth. And night consciousness would definitely be more the Dionysian spirit. So this is something that would lead to visionary states. So it's almost as though, you know, if you're going about your day and you are essentially, you know, basically intaking and computing your environment and your thoughts, it's all being cataloged by the brain. You know, you maybe wake up, you go to your place of work, you see to the jobs that you need to do, and there's nothing really to crack that sort of veneer. You're conscious, but it's essentially what I guess might be defined as a verbal consciousness. You're almost narrating your life, and it's going about a very orderly way. Night consciousness would be that eruption where you're suddenly fully inhabiting that present moment. And in my own terminology that I talk about in the Benighted Path, I would say that, you know, in this moment, you are having a depth experience. So something that was latent or hidden or, you know, basically almost occult in the sense that it is sort of obscured within the everyday, suddenly erupts. It's bloomed. And you're not merely just computing that which is around you. You are fully present in it, and you're receiving that almost like a gift. So it takes on this, what Rimbaud would call the poetic sense. So, you know, if you're driving on a country road, and suddenly the way that the clouds are gathering and the treetops might be billowing in this wind, it suddenly takes on this completely evocative air, and you are at that moment, in my belief, engaging in a dialogue with this depth, with this hidden or latent aspect. So you're engaged with something. So suddenly the environment or the object is not merely things around you or inert objects. It's actually become portals or like a vital link that connects you with this ongoing current of becoming. So when I use the sort of dark light dichotomy or the Dionysian Apollo dichotomy, it's less about contrariness and more to show that one is often latent and one is dominant. And in modernity, you know, this world is definitely more of a product of Apollo. And I think that is where the great imbalance has taken place, because we often spend the bulk of our time in artificial environments with artificial lighting, and we're constantly bombarded by artificial stimulus, whether it's social media or television. And so there's a great divide between the natural world, between our instincts, between taking that moment to allow the subtle or latent to speak, because they're often just, you know, they have to break through this wall of light, of artificial stimulus, of artificial light. You know, it's very difficult to even find true darkness in most developed areas because there's just this constant light. So it's about the cultivation and the means by which a person can begin to build those inroads towards receiving this dialogue, participating in this night consciousness.
Do you think this dichotomy that you've got here of light and dark goes back to Plato's allegory of the cave? And with regards to our understanding of truth, we are more comfortable with forms of truth that are lit up because we can understand them via our own means of lighting something up, our own systems of truth. But we treat darkness as we're hostile towards it because inherently we have an inability to understand it. You know, with regards to Plato's cave, this is sort of what's going on there. Do you think that's that would be a correct reading?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. Because I think that, you know, very often with the entire notion of darkness, it's often in various traditions, particularly in a lot of the current esoteric traditions, they either flaunt this supposedly dark or frightening imagery for a kind of adolescent contrarian stance. You know, they want to be dark and evil while the rest of the world is light and good, or they look to it as something that's essentially got to be worked through. So in other words, well, we'll just make the unconscious conscious, you know, in a kind of Jungian sense. And then eventually I'll be completed and everything will be under control because my intellect will then be aware of all of these facets of my life. And I think that's essentially a wrongheaded approach. I don't know that such a thing is impossible. I don't think that such a thing is possible at all. And I also wonder why one would want that, to live in a state where they are constantly under this neurotic need for control. And I think that your mention of Plato's cave is an apt model, because yes, there is definitely an impulse to cast this darkness off rather than not only explore it but participate in it, to engage with it. For me, that has always been just my natural inclination. Again, why that is, I can't say, but I know that it has always just resonated more with me and has offered me more and has been a much more direct and enthusing force in my life. This kind of almost irrational, poetical sense that's it inspires me creatively. It's informed my worldview, my views on the natural world. So I think it's for myself just a more direct way, and I think it's a way that modernity has, you know, arguably since the Age of Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, but even going back to the dominant Abrahamic faiths that essentially, you know, say that this world essentially has humans at the top of the pinnacle of this creation, that this world is essentially a catalog of resources for us to use because we are favored by, you know, a creator. And for me, that is just simply not the case. You know, there's a process where once the ego is, if not eliminated, then certainly diminished, that allows for a much fuller comprehension of existence.
So when we have these areas of darkness, you know, metaphorically speaking, when we have these areas of darkness, of complete unknowing, of strangeness or outsideness, our compulsion within modernity is to instantly light it up, which is sort of, metaphorically speaking, a way to control it and to subsume it into a pre-known system. Whereas what you're saying is a better way, or perhaps better is the wrong word here, but a more intriguing and engaged way of exploration with regards to oneself and one's life is not to repel it and not to try and understand it in your own means, but just to investigate it and say, okay, well, let's walk into the darkness. Let's see what happens. Let's see what's going on here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what you often find out is that there's, you know, it's this, there is a fullness to it, a dynamism to it, rather than, you know, a mere absence of light or a vacuum or a void. So it's, you know, it's a much richer experience to essentially not attempt to define, to narrow down, to illuminate, you know, to take this quirk of oneself or some aspect that they feel is just almost like a subconscious impulse, and then essentially say, well, I've just got to be aware of this and define it and name it, and I will get it under control. Ultimately, you know, we are in a sense icebergs. You know, the notion of making the subconscious conscious is really, I think, a drive from this Apollo mind, this egoic solar consciousness, to really bring things under control, because most people just prefer their life that way. They do, I don't think that the idea of an ongoing process, which in my opinion also encompasses one's own death, is as digestible, I suppose, as the notion that things are clear and defined and each thing is distinct and separate, and there's, you know, it's very clean. And I think that's where a lot of art comes in, you know, horror fiction comes in, because it also addresses these kinds of themes. And I think that underneath a lot of the reflexive thinking, the automatic thinking, the programmed thinking of social conditioning and so forth, there is a desire to revel in this, even if it is only on an aesthetic level of, say, reading a horror story, of watching the order decay, of watching, you know, of confronting the notion of a spirit, the notion of, you know, one's own demise. I think these are important things that people, as much as we try to move away from them, are still innately drawn to.
Do you think then that this way of being, the typical way of being in which people want comfort and light, do you think that our sort of understanding of morality and what is ethically and moralistically correct or right, or right and wrong, has been applied to the spectrum of darkness and light, but incorrectly, in the way that everything that's dark is seen as bad or weird or strange, but always sort of ethically wrong?
But everything that's light and understood is correct. Would you agree with that statement?
I think it is, and even if it's on a very kind of fainter or subtler level, I mean, when we really look at the phenomenon, most of the notions of, I guess, what could be called a kind of seeking for modern enlightenment, or at least this idea of self-control and self-awareness and so forth, it's less about empowering a person to live a full and deep life, and I think more about giving them the rules that will make them a better and more productive civilian. You know, it's really essentially looking to make people to be better fitting cogs within the great machine. I think that's essentially a great aspect of why this compulsion has been so dominant. Is it's less about it being in harmony with truth or with the human equation, and more about it creating better citizens who are able to then go about their duties. So I think this is, again, where spiritual practice, meditation, art, whatever resonates most deeply with the person, are crucial, because the latent or obscured elements, this darker current, still requires expression, and still it requires a level of engagement. So I think that is where these other practices that are outside of the social norms, so to speak, are absolutely vital, because they enable the person to delve more deeply into this Dionysian nature, to view this natural world in its fullness, to have these poetical moments. These things are basically not seen as utilitarian or useful or productive, I suppose, unless you could, you know, perhaps produce a work of art that could be seen as entertainment, that could make people money, then perhaps it would fit in. But generally, you know, even that is kind of viewed as just simple escapism. You know, I suppose people are allowed to take in that movie or read that novel on their weekend because it's, you know, it's harmless escapism, as long as they're not truly affected by it and it doesn't alter their worldview in any great way, because they, you know, they need to be productive again on Monday morning. So I think, yeah, that's a big part of it, is that there is the social conditioning is absolutely based on that premise. And I think it's less about truth, reality, and more about utilitarianism and usefulness within keeping the machine going.
Mm-hmm. Whereabouts in Klages can one read about the night consciousness?
Well, I know he. My first discovery of Klages with night consciousness was through the writings of David Beth, who I know has been a guest on your show. Mm-hmm. And they're basically, with night consciousness, it is harmonious with Klages' view of the soul, of a kind of pandemonic reality. And the Cosmogonic Eros, which was recently republished and actually published in English for the first time through Theon Publishing, has got a really wonderful overview of this view. You know, Klages is a difficult read at times. You know, he's a little bit dense, but what I suggest to people when they ask me about Klages is, his dichotomy was, of course, the spirit versus the soul, which can be a bit confusing because, you know, in his native German, it was, of course, the Geist versus the soul. And to view the spirit versus the soul a bit more accessibly is to think of, whenever Klages refers to the spirit, think of it as the intellect. Mm-hmm. And the soul as being essentially, you know, your spiritual nature. And that tends to show the divide a bit more clearly, and also helps, I think, sharpen Klages' argument for getting towards more of a biocentric, phenomenal engagement with the world. So his view of night consciousness is, you know, very much resonant with my own. I confess, I was not even familiar with Klages until I encountered David's writings some years ago. And it was through our own correspondence and talk over the years that, you know, eventually the Benighted Path manifested. So it was quite interesting. It was just this figure I discovered, you know, fairly late in my life, who was articulating a lot of the views that I held and was also, you know, intuited, but was perhaps not able to define with such clarity. So Cosmogonic Eros would definitely be a title that I would recommend to your listeners.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there the this primordial darkness, this primitive idea, and this comes up a lot in David Beth's writing, comes up a lot in Klager's. And what it seems to me is that you're saying that there's almost the beauty of darkness, unlike light, is that everything descends to darkness eventually. Everything succumbs to entropy, returns to zero, as I always like to put it. So really, the darkness is the primitive. Whatever that originary state would be, it would be from darkness, because light is sort of a fleeting gasp at anything, you know, that anything can be outlined, whereas darkness is always what it's going to return to, right?
Indeed, indeed. And I think also as well, it's this eternal process of you know, manifestation and dissolution and this ongoing flux and change. And they're intimately connected. You know, darkness, as I describe it in the book, is not only it's not merely the absence of light, because it can manifest in broad daylight in a completely pastoral setting. I view it as also being essentially the depth of a thing, the latent potentia of a thing, its hidden significance, its soul, if you will. So in other words, you know, you could be out for a walk through a wooded grove on a sunny day and suddenly have this awareness of this primordial darkness, of really seeing the poetical significance, the spiritual significance of the trees, of, you know, the environment that you're in, the way that the sun is, you know, passing over the boughs of the trees and so forth. You know, this immediacy, this presence is what really makes the darkness more dynamic, you know, it because it essentially is a kind of potentia. It really does offer the mystery and infinite possibilities of any given scene, setting, you know, no matter where you are. So it can inspire, you know, it can essentially, you may go and say, write a poem or paint a picture, or it may inspire a story if you're a fiction writer. And what then happens with that is that you then have forged a ligament, a direct link that for yourself and hopefully others will encounter that and comprehend a bit of that moment, of that experience. So it really is a vital element, and it is essentially rooted in this darkness, because it is not about me. You know, it is not about my own ego when I have these experiences. It is not about what I want something to be or wish something to be. It's really being more receptive to it and having this participatory, reciprocal engagement.
So yeah, and you do write, darkness is only a vacuum to those not attuned to its denizens and its dynamic nature. So in what way can you attune yourself to darkness then? Is there ways, you know, you're talking about walking through even a, you know, a lit park, and you can sort of have this depth experience of understanding that there is this primitive dark reality to all things. Is there ways in which one can attune themselves to this?
Yeah, I think that there is, you know, and provided that they really have this innate draw to it. I would say one is to essentially, whether it is through meditative practice or through, you know, a magical practice or, you know, any sort of process where you can limit the constant narration of the egoic self. In other words, you know, the intellect is going to constantly want to define, dismiss, describe. So there are ways to overcome that by essentially just following one's own intuition towards, you know, a particular experience. So when I mentioned earlier with Rimbaud and this kind of poetic sense, there is this dialogue with the hidden, but it is a very subtle experience. And so I think what you have to then do is really just begin to orient yourself towards accepting these moments, you know, trying to be as present within them as you can. And, you know, essentially just really allowing yourself or to allowing the object or the environment to work on you, to become something that is vital in your life. So, you know, it can be, well, what do I do with this sense or this presence? Well, it depends. I mean, it can be an individual spirit wishing to work with you. You know, it may present its name, or it may send you an image. That's something that you could replicate or work with as offerings. It could also inspire you to create a work of art. As I said, essentially it's really allowing oneself to have those instinctual moments that are not dominated and narrated by the eye. Because, that white shape I just saw skitter across the path that I'm hiking on tonight, well, that was just a trick of the light. What does this mean? What, you know, how could this possibly be related to what I have to do tomorrow? These kinds of things, they allow yourself to basically just try and shut them off and allow the environment to work on you or the object to work on you. So it can be something as basic as if there is a, you know, a particular object that, you know, you find fascinating, you know, study it by candlelight. And one of the other areas that I often tell people is follow your fear. And the reason I say that is because if fear is not the goal, which it never really should be, it is always a signifier that you are reaching the horizon of your own experience. So again, going back to Bataille, it's this notion of a limit experience. When your hackles are raised, when you feel your eyes water, and there's no obvious immediate threat per se, so it's not a fight or flight instinct response. This goes back to Otto's Mysterium Tremendum. This is, you are in the presence of something that has now overshadowed your preconceptions of the world. So follow that. You know, use that as essentially almost like your compass to lead you into places that perhaps, yes, make you uncomfortable, or they're eerie, or they seem haunted. These are other ways that allow it to work on you, and not as something to be overcome, you know, not as something that you have to sort of prove to yourself that you were, you know, brave enough to sit in that cemetery at night, or brave enough to hike that path by yourself. It's more about following it, because it is stretching your reality. It is stretching your existence into this new undefined dark territory. So those would be some basic, you know, without being too specific on anything, those would be some basic techniques that people could adopt if they are seeking to have more of these kinds of experiences.
Mm-hmm. And do you you mentioned fear there. Do you differentiate between like fear, horror, cosmic horror? Because I know, you know, I've spoken about definitions between fear, horror, and cosmic horror before, but you actually introduced one that I haven't come across before called sacred horror. So is there differences between these in terms of the way in which they affect a person?
I think so, because essentially if we look at the cosmic horror, at least in the kind of classic Lovecraftian sense, I do think that awe is absolutely there. The unknown is there. But generally speaking, cosmic horror tends to lead to a sense of insignificance, or, you know, a sense that we're these hopeless little specks on a rock in space. And, you know, there's certainly a level of truth to that. But where I define sacred horror, or, you know, also referring to it as holy dread, is this signifier, is that essentially it is not that what one is seeing or experiencing or sensing is necessarily horrific, although, you know, it can be very other and frightening, but it is that your nervous system is striving to convey the most receptive state possible. So when we are afraid, our eyes widen so we can see more, you know, our skin crawls because we're absolutely inhabited and present in our body. You know, we're not completely trapped up in our own minds working through things. It's an immediate, you know, call to consciousness. You know, that's how I believe fear generally works, is that it is a call to consciousness. And when the source of that is not, as I said, a direct threat, or something that is, very blatant, but is instead this sort of subtle inkling, the feeling that perhaps you are not alone in this grove, or, perhaps that there is something to the notion of this particular house being haunted. It's areas such as that where this horror is then leading you towards the numinous. So it then leads into this direct apprehension and dialogue with this deeper reality. So in a sense, I think Lovecraft was doing that in a lot of his stories, but I think sometimes, as particularly these days, the notion of it being, a kind of instinct, it's, you might as well just be a nihilist because, it's all just meaningless materialism going about its ordinary cycles, which we don't have any participation with, and then eventually you're going to just dissolve into nothingness. Whereas this is much more of a present moment with these latent forms of spiritual life. So I think that would be the distinction. So there is a connection, but I think that ultimately, with me, sacred horror is definitely linked to the direct experience with the numinous.
And then what then become, you have these horror experiences which sort of fragment your reality in such a way that there's this clear inhumanity, something that is so other than what you already are, that you have to alter in certain ways. In, what happens to the basic parts of you in this process, your ego? What happens to your ego, when it comes face to face with these forms of horror?
Well, for me, I think what's interesting is that I believe that the self is not at all holistic, that the self is essentially yes, it is unique in the sense that it is a particularized collection, but it is nevertheless a collection of ancestral spirit powers, one's own spirits one may have worked with, it's nature spirits. So in other words, it is a legion, it is a protean thing that is multifaceted. And the ego, as I define it, is essentially the intellect desperately trying to wedge itself in there to almost create a divide between these, what David Beth would call the sort of pandemonic powers, and this singularity. So the ironic thing too, with mentioning, otherness and this idea of it being a horror, all things carry a trace of their own opposite. And that which is most other from us has a connection to us. We carry a piece of that within us. And therefore, I think that the more shocking or more other that be it an image or a concept or, a God form, whatever seems most removed from us and yet strikes us with this kind of, with this dread, with this awe-tinged terror, is because at a level that is well beyond the intellect's reach, there is that resonance. One then participates with that. One then, cultivates that aspect within themselves. So we go about life and we are, various different beings at any point in time. It is this ongoing process. And there's absolutely no need, really, beyond, again, going back to that sort of utilitarian notion, there's no need to pinion it to a particularized individual set of behaviors and speech patterns. And, this is the I, this is what I am. And these other things are aberrations. Well, no, they are all you. And you are going to be these various different aspects at different points in your life. And, depending, this is the great aspect too, to the notion of having this spiritual practice. One does not necessarily have to then, quit your job and run off and live in a shack in the woods in order to fully access this. One can have an ongoing practice and still completely immerse oneself, to don that other mask and go back about their life and very much inhabit a day-to-day life, that kind of, the Apollonian world. It's still going to forge this perfect balance because both are being given this expression. You know, it cannot just be the egoic self that gets expression. So, you know, they are necessary, but again, it's going back to that monumental imbalance that has happened, you know, since the Enlightenment in the Industrial Revolution, where the one is completely favored and the other is essentially cast off as something abject and unclean.
So do you think that before the spirit or the intellect inserts itself like a wedge, do you think prior to that, prior to this formation of a singular platonic ego of sorts, prior to that, do you think that we were inherently connected to the Lucretian reality of the cosmos, that everything changes and we shouldn't latch on?
I think there was absolutely examples of, you know, throughout the world and a lot of, you know, more primordial societies, the interaction with the world was, I think, nearer to that model than to this relatively young model that has dominated, especially in the West, has dominated today. But I think it can one can absolutely build inroads back to it. It's simply, you know, really recognizing that a great deal of these definitions and perceptions have had more to do with cultural conditioning than to one's own innate inklings and one's own nature. You know, I mentioned earlier that I'd always had these kinds of affinities for these darker and you know, either more macabre or more mysterious or more other elements of the world. And although I didn't understand why at the time, it was essentially the better part of my life has been spent more in night consciousness than day consciousness. You know, I was a classic daydreamer in school. I was a, you know, mediocre student at best. All of my education came from being an autodidact because I was essentially more interested in seeking these things that were important to me rather than, you know, engaging in this world that as a child I didn't really understand and as an adolescent I didn't really resonate with. So it came about from constantly having this almost, you know, trance state. So I could be in the world and I could be going about my day, but I was always more attuned to this potentia, to this latent element, whether it was, you know, wow, this really inspires a story, the way that, you know, this snippet of conversation has occurred, or, you know, I had this instance of out walking and I noticed this strange image that kind of tweaked my imagination. So it's almost like this ongoing process of, you know, building a mosaic, I suppose, where all these different snippets from all your facets of your life are feeding in and being fed by this more latent, intuitive soul. And as one goes about life, I think they can absolutely, you know, build those inroads back, because fundamentally we are still on this planet. We have built a lot of the artificial stimuli all around us to really make that almost a temple or a shrine to day consciousness. But night consciousness is absolutely vital. You know, just essentially, if you want to experience that vitality, you know, as I said, take that moment and undergo those excursions for yourself. You know, understand that a lot of this is not essentially because this model of reality has been proven and this other type has been disproven. There are thousands of years of various examples, perhaps not using the same terminology that I use, but nevertheless having this kind of symbiotic relationship with ancestral spirits and nature and, you know, and the cosmos and a deeper world that has gone on in every culture all over the world and continues on to this day. So it's really, you know, when one grasps that fact, it then broadens the possibilities, the spectrum of possibilities.
And what interests me, and this is a question that I've asked quite a few guests who've come on, who are coming from different paths, and David Beth said, you know, this is probably the biggest question, I think, within occultist spheres, is what do you think then that people who are inhabiting the night consciousness as a sort of, you know, that's people's default mode of being, what do you think this has done to the idea of death for us and suffering sort of secondary to that, primarily death? And what happens to death once you sort of inherit the night consciousness way of being?
I think really what happens is the same that would happen with everything, and that is that it undergoes a transformation. You know, in my own belief, which has come not just from, you know, reading, but from direct experience with spirits and so forth, is that it is ongoing. So what I am, you know, the person that is speaking to you now is absolutely going to cease to exist at some point in time. Mm-hmm. But it will undergo, in my opinion, a radical transformation and yet still be intimately connected with this elemental primordial reality. Not at all, you know, I have serious doubts that I would, you know, I'm going to recognize it or remember it in the intellectual sense, but it is this ongoing process. And that's how I believe all life moves, is that it absolutely moves inevitably towards this ultimate transformation at the end. We have this grand transformation at the beginning with the womb, and it leads to the tomb. And it is a transformation that is probably the ultimate mystery. Can, you know, any attempts to define would essentially be to diminish or to essentially make something that's a bit more, I guess, pat and convenient and accessible. But I, in my opinion, yes, it will. I will absolutely continue on in this continuum. However, I hold no illusions about going on, or my individual awareness, as it were, outlasting physical death. No, because I believe that the phenomenal realm is completely imbued with these other forms of energy, these latent energies. And how I will transform, I cannot say. You know, that, as I said, is probably the greatest mystery. But that's how I view the concept of death. And it's interesting because I think that, particularly in the West, we have just developed probably one of the most unhealthy perceptions of death in human history. I mean, it is really, we shut it out. We try to sanitize it. You know, people are distanced from the corpse. They are distanced from the process. You know, it's all done behind closed doors. It's rarely talked about. And I think what has happened as a result of that is an extremely unhealthy perception of the entire process, regardless of whether or not one, you know, agrees with my views of it being a continuum. And if someone is, let's say, a rationalist materialist and believes that, you know, it completely snuffs out when the body dies, even still, it is still the manner in which death is dealt with is completely unhealthy, in my opinion. I think it's essentially one of the great nagging problems of modernity, is that it's we are obsessed with not only comfort, as we talked about earlier, but also this kind of eternal youthhood and the idea that, you know, people have basically almost tricked themselves into believing that they're not going to die, or that death is just something that happens to somebody else. And all of these things, I think, have just created a completely unhealthy and negative veneer over the whole process.
You've been extremely articulate with these questions, so I'm finding and covering
all the bases. Thank you very much.
Covering the bases. There's one other thing which has come up in David's work, and it comes up a few times in The Benighted Path. There's this mm-hmm. idea of supreme, is it catabasis?
Yeah, is that actually pronounced? Yes.
Sorry, how's it actually pronounced?
No, go ahead. Yeah, I've heard it pronounced a few different ways.
Okay, and it avoids all notions of traditional enlightenment. So could you expand on this idea?
Absolutely, yes. Well, the process of catabasis, mm-hmm. or I've also heard it pronounced catabasis, but essentially it's an ancient Greek concept that is the descent into the underworld where the dead reside. And that is a fundamental process for myself. I know it is for David as well, and for a lot of other practitioners who study and work in similar lines. The reason why I say that it is not connected in any way to the classical ideas of enlightenment is it is less about an aspirational goal of a means to reach, let's say, a detached state of perfected enlightenment. It is more of that descent into the depths, which is heavily populated with spirits. And again, this is a nice encapsulation of a lot of the principles that we've been talking about through this conversation is this idea that darkness is a potentia. It is brimming with forms of consciousness and energy. And I do believe that the dead just don't simply disappear. They are essentially vitally present, but again, it's that latent presence. So for me, this notion of a descent has been the great theme that reaches throughout my life, because I have always been drawn towards, I guess, sort of digging up and seeing the worms at the bottom of the flower box. I've been more interested in really understanding the soul of the thing, of the dark potentia of the thing, than just the object itself, than its expression. And the expression, I think, is intimately connected to this underworld. But when one descends, one is then basically saying, I want to experience this as profoundly and as deeply as I possibly can. So it has nothing really to do with this concept of it being, you know, let's say evil or satanic, as opposed to aspiring towards godliness and the light. Again, this is, I would hope anyway, quite apparently to people, quite removed from this sort of adolescent contrarianism, and more to do with, you know, I wish to experience this. I'm going to study this thing and commune with this thing or this spirit or this place as deeply as I can, and have this symbiotic relationship where it will then provide me with inspiration. I provide it with, you know, with, there's this long, long tradition of spirits, for instance, particularly in voodoo, of the use of the body. You know, of having this intimate connection back to the fleshly realm. Mm-hmm. So it is all, there is that this intimate connection. And so for me, delving into the depths has always been the most important element of any of my endeavors, whether that is writing fiction or doing my own spiritual practice or writing a work of esotericism. It is always about trying to perceive the depth, or perceive that which is most subtle or latent or hidden, and nourish it and bring it forth and give it context. So this, incidentally, is why I tend to prefer to refer to a lot of my nonfiction work as esotericism rather than traditional occultism. And it's not, you know, it's not because I have any particular issue with occultism per se. It's just that this work applies to much more than just, let's say, you know, Western ceremonial magical traditions or paganism or what have you. It inhabits a variety of different areas, whether it's you know, poetry, or it is animism, or some of the tribal consciousness. It encompasses all various things, trance states and so on, but always with the aim of apprehending and communicating with this inner darkness, this depth. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, is there anything you think we've missed, or anything you'd like to add in?
No, not at all. I mean, I will say to the listeners, I mean, if they are interested in this, I'm currently working on the next book for Theon, which I hope to turn into David Beth sometime this autumn. And hopefully it will be out next year. It again builds on a lot of these concepts and takes them into some new areas. So if this has been of interest to them, there's definitely more material to come in the future.
Okay. I think that's a pretty good place to finish up.
Well, excellent. Well, thanks so much. This has been excellent. I really appreciated you having me on.
Okay, thank you.